Are you curious about the economic forces shaping your daily life? The Planet Money podcast from NPR makes sense of the economy in ways you'll actually understand and enjoy. Guys, you love listening to the rundowns. I get some of that information from this NPR Planet Money podcast, especially recently with the war going on, the Strait of Hormuz. You're just kind of getting those updates as they come from these guys. They put out a ton of awesome content. It's a different perspective from Crypto 101, but still a great listen. So go over there and check out the Planet Money podcast if stuff like current events and the finance world interest you. Each story on Planet Money starts with a question. Recent episodes ask why Pokemon cards are growing faster than your retirement account. Questions about the war, just like we talked about recently a lot on our program. From the job market to the stock market to prices at the supermarket, Planet Money explains it all. Planet Money is a different kind of world where the complex economy somehow makes sense, where human stories supersede abstract theories so you can learn, laugh, and be entertained. It's econ, but just down to earth. The hosts go to unusual lengths to explain the economy. They've published their own book to track the global supply chain. They've shot a satellite into space to understand the economics of the private space industry. They've gone inside a live book auction to show how ideas get to market. It's the kind of show where you learn something, probably laugh, and walk away seeing the world a little differently. And I think if you like Crypto 101, you'll enjoy Planet Money. So maybe check that out. Follow NPR's Planet Money podcast and understand how money shapes the world. One thing I love about summer is everything's just getting easier. You're outside more, you're taking vacations, and it's the time where you're really not trying to overthink every outfit. You just want stuff that feels good, works, and sometimes is a little cool. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. They make those pieces that you end up just wearing all season. For me, it's the 100% European linen shirt and the matching linen pants. That has become one of my go-to beach vacation outfits. I've gotten so many compliments on it. It's breathable. It's comfortable. It looks put together, but it still feels relaxed. You can literally wear this thing going to the beach all day, walking by the water for a sunset, and then head straight to dinner later, feeling completely comfortable and looking fast. Fashionable. And that's really what Quince does well. Their 100% European linen pants and shirts are easy to wear, perfect for summer, and the price is unbelievable. And they start at literally just $34. They also have soft tees you can wear all day, plus lightweight cotton sweaters that are perfect for when the temperature drops a little at night. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middleman, so you're paying for exceptional quality, not the brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become one of those brands people trust for home, travel, and everyday essentials too. You've heard me talk about their website before. It's super fun to scroll around. They literally have everything. So make your summer wardrobe easier. Go to quince.com/crypto101 for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/crypto101 for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/crypto101.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your host, Bryce. As always, joined by my good buddy across the country, Brendan. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good, Bryce. How about yourself?
You know, no complaints at all. We've got an incredible guest today. So, look, I'm super excited. I have seen John D'Agostino on CNBC pretty much every week for the past couple weeks. And so it is a true joy to have you, John, join us, head of Coinbase's institutional strategy. John, welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Bryce. Thanks to you and Brendan for having me today.
Yeah, no, we're really pumped. You know, we've had different folks from the Coinbase ecosystem join us. And so we're really excited to dive into particularly things that you are all doing on the institutional side, you know, which is probably, in my opinion, the most interesting aspect of Coinbase, because that's what's going to be driving the adoption. That's what's going to be driving over the course of the next decade, really the big price movements in crypto as well. So we're not going to be speculating on price. We're not going to be providing financial or investment advice or recommendations, but we are going to be looking at the landscape from high level. Before we do, John, we just want to get acquainted with you, with the audience. Tell us a little bit about how you got into crypto, into the role that you are right now.
Sure, happy to do it. The quick version is I've always been attracted to sort of idiosyncratic asset classes. So When I graduated business school, instead of going the traditional route, I took a weird job with a weird little building on the corner of North End Avenue in New York called the New York Mercantile Exchange. And that's where commodity derivatives were traded. Yeah, the NYMEX. Yeah, back when it was, where I caught the tail end of the open outcry era, the sort of wild, crazy days. If any of your older viewers ever saw the movie Trading Places, that was filmed on the floor.
With Eddie Murphy.
That was filmed on the floor of the exchange. So got to see the sort of tail end. And what was interesting is I got to see the capital markets undergo one major transformation, which was shifting from open outcry to electronic trading, or the electronification of trading. And I always just kind of liked that. I liked volatility. I liked kind of the math was hard. I liked options math. It always seemed more interesting and more fun to me. So I built a career in that and then went on to trade at a hedge fund in the same asset class. And just developed an academic curiosity about crypto. I've been lecturing at MIT for over a decade now and started studying crypto from an academic perspective. And the way I got into it, to be very frank, is I wrote a paper right after the Dow hack. And I analyzed the Dow hack with an MIT professor, and we published this paper. And in the paper, I called myself a cynical enthusiast about crypto because I was super excited about the tech. I was a little bit cynical about the people. And that paper caught the attention of a hedge fund called Polychain, a pretty famous fund, and they put me on the board of directors.
Olaf Carlson Wee.
Olaf, I think, read the paper, or at least I was told he did, and wound up being on the board of Polychain, so good practical learning about crypto there, and then got the call from Coinbase when they started building out their institutional arm.
The institutional side has been a booming one for sure. I mean, look at the last couple of years here. It's been big, especially on the ETF side, which we'll get into because you guys play a big role in a lot of those ETFs that have exploded onto the scene in, let's say, the last two or so years. But can you help the general audience maybe understand a little bit more? A lot of them use you all. We've talked about you for a while. And I don't think that they're as familiar with the institutional side. They say, oh, hey, it's Coinbase. You know, I use them as my brokerage. I buy a little Bitcoin and altcoins through them. Yeah. And I want to get into some of these other features. But beyond that, what really is the giant behind the scenes of the institutional side?
Nice.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that opportunity because it is interesting to me. So when people say, when they talk about institutional, I think they underrepresent the degree of influence that sector is going to have on crypto. Yeah. So let's say, for example, like when you say who's the biggest institutional player in crypto, right? People say BlackRock, which is fair to some degree, and they've been a fantastic partner of ours. But the majority of BlackRock is as a conduit for retail. So it's through their massively successful ETF and other types of products. Same thing when we read about, you know, big firms like Fidelity and Franklin Templeton and Schwab and everyone getting into crypto. For the large part, that's going to largely be as a conduit to broad-based retail. So I know that crypto, to some degree, part of the wonderful characteristics of crypto is the ability of self-ownership through self-custodial wallets and the ability for anyone in the world who can afford some compute and some power to participate in the ecosystem. And that is a wonderful characteristic that is essential to the value proposition. The reality of how most people think about their money is they rely on some type of intermediary and some type of advisor. So until the day where we're all knowledgeable enough to make, comfortable enough to make our own investment decisions and then more so want to, you know, I use a financial advisor. I'm perfectly capable of managing my own money. I choose not to. I just choose to allocate that time to my children and my hobbies. So I think for a long time we will be relying on these financial intermediaries and advisors. And so that is a big chunk of institutional. Then the other piece you have is what I call asset owners. So asset owners are, you know, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, insurance pools, who are investing on behalf of themselves for the most part. I mean, they may have citizens, but on behalf of their own entity. And then finally, you have, you know, folks like hedge funds who are kind of act like asset owners. They make their own investment decisions, but they have fiduciaries that they have to make money for or have responsibility to, which are either retail or institutional investors. So if you add all those up together, they are a massively powerful and influential form of capital development. And that's where we focus on. But again, it's not just making money for corporations. It's assisting those corporations and those companies in assisting their retail clients. Mm.
Which side would you say makes up most of the business? Is it the retail or the institutional?
So it depends. I think I should know this. I think there's volume, which is largely retail, and then there's profitability, which I think institutional, I think it's about 30%. I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I think about 30% now, maybe a little bit higher. So we certainly have more retail, certainly 120, maybe even more now at this point, retail users.
120 million, right?
We are certainly much larger on retail, 120 or more million users. Institutions tend to use capital markets more, and they tend to use it in different ways. They tend to borrow. They obviously use us for custody. They use us for trading, best execution, both just over the centralized exchange, but also OTC orders. So your institutional business can constitute more activity over time. But Coinbase was first and foremost a retail organization.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you guys have really leaned into the new product development. I think one of the coolest things that I've seen recently was the SEC registered AI agent financial advisor, the very first of its kind. I was like, when I saw this, I was like, oh my gosh, how cool. I mean, this is for sure going to be the way of the future. No more, you know, 9 to 5, can't talk to your advisor on the weekends or the holidays, or he goes on vacation and you're trying to get some orders in. Like, this is 365, 7 days a week, 24/7. So I want to talk a little bit about maybe some of the new products that y'all have launched. I know PERPs, the perpetual derivatives contracts, are starting to make a big push. Can you give us an overview of some of the things that maybe Coinbase has launched or things that you've been involved with as well?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we just had our system reset. So Brian got up on stage with some of the other leaders of the firm and talked through a ton of these, you know, wonderful, wonderful products. And I think thematically, if you just start from the top down, it's all about this notion of an everything app and consolidating the average person, the average institution's, you know, financial transaction needs all in one place. And so we need, as a business and as an industry, we need to prove the value of transacting on chain in all of its forms. Mm-hmm. So we all can intuitively understand the value of receiving payment in minutes versus months. That intuitively makes sense to everyone. But what might not be as obvious to everyone is the value of consolidating different types of asset classes all onto one fungible platform, which is what we're trying to do through PERPs, tokenized equities, as well as PERPs on commodities, and eventually moving all of that on chain to exist alongside digital asset assets. The reason that's really important, especially for institutions, is it makes the process of giving and receiving leverage much safer and cleaner. So if you think about, like, so if I'm long gold, just physical gold or derivatives on gold, and I'm short gold miners via equities, it's challenging to find one institution that can effectively lend against that entire pool of assets and giving you the proper credit for the offset of the commodity position versus the short equity position. Mm. And that's not their fault. It's just that no one can be good at everything, right? It's very, very different. It's a very different skill set, very different group of people you have to hire to get good at making markets and equities versus credit versus commodities versus derivatives, because they all exist on very, very different systems. And if we can start over time to consolidate that activity on chain and make those instruments fungible, then you A, improve liquidity, and B, you make it a lot safer to lend, because as a lender, I know I have an ability to sell or move those assets quickly and efficiently if I need to.
You know what slows teams down more than anything? It's not always headcount, budget, or even the tools themselves. It's when the way work gets done lives in someone's head and never actually gets documented. Then someone new joins, a new platform gets rolled out, or a teammate leaves, and suddenly everyone's doing the same process in a different way. That's exactly the problem today's sponsor, Scribe, was built to solve. Scribe is a workflow AI platform that captures any workflow in real time and turns it into a step-by-step documentation automatically. You just turn on the extension, do the process like you normally would, and Scribe builds the guide as you go, capturing every click, step, and screenshot. And it's already trusted trusted by over 80,000 enterprises, including nearly half of the Fortune 500. With our team being remote, I have definitely had moments where I've had to explain the same setup or process more than once to a colleague, and it always feels like something that should have been documented the first time. With Scribe, what could take hours of writing, screenshots, and cleanup can be ready to share in under a minute. Scribe also automatically redacts sensitive information like names, emails, and account numbers from screenshots. Admins can enforce that across the team so nothing slips through the cracks. Plus, anyone following the process can get real-time on-screen guidance showing exactly where to click inside the actual tool. And Scribe doesn't just document workflows. It uses AI to suggest ways to improve them, helping you spot redundant steps, bottlenecks, and places to simplify. To book a personalized enterprise demo, visit scribe.how/crypto101. That's scribe.how/crypto101. If you've been sitting on a business idea, Shopify is the place where you can actually make it real. The thing I like about Shopify is it takes the scary part out of starting. You're not just sitting there trying to figure out a website, payments, checkout, inventory, all these little things that stop people before they even launch. When I think about building a storefront, the biggest thing is friction. You want someone to land on your page, like what you're selling, and be able to buy without getting stuck. That's where Shopify is huge. Shopify checkout is built to help more customers finish their purchase. And when they come back, their details are already saved. One tap and they're done. The cool part is Shopify powers millions of businesses worldwide, from huge brands that you know, like Mattel and Gymshark, to small businesses just getting started. So whether you're building the next big brand or launching your first product, the infrastructure is already there. Once that part is handled, you can focus on the real work, building the brand, getting attention, and bringing people to your storefront so the business can grow. That moment when someone actually buys, that's when the idea becomes real. With Shopify, nothing stands between your idea and a real business, so go make it one. Start your free trial today at shopify.com/crypto101. That's a free trial at shopify.com/crypto101.
You know, one of the things that you just mentioned was the whole perps area. And obviously, this has been pretty closely tied to the crypto community, because I would say when people think of perps, right, they largely think of crypto-based perps, right? Just in the same way that I would say if you think of like futures and options, you probably think of the traditional markets. Yeah. I would, as someone who's involved in both, when I think of perps, I think of like, hey, go trade crypto. But it's been kind of this back and forth, especially inside the US here. And I saw that recently Coinbase updated its US perp listings. And this was something that launched, I think it was last July. And so when this update changed, the term or the listing was changed from, I believe it was US styled perps to now just being US perps.
Yeah.
So what does that actually change? And what does that mean for the users that are interested in this kind of thing?
Yeah, so the requirement to call it U.S. style was based on current then regulatory requirements, and the CFTC came out with a relief letter, a no action letter, that basically said that we could eliminate the need to use that modifier because we didn't have to. Really, the only difference was we had set a very, very long duration for the future, for the perpetual future, and they allowed us to, quite frankly, state the obvious, which is these things really have no termination date, and call it what it is, which is a perpetual future, and offer those to U.S. citizens for the first time. So, perps have been around for a long time, by the way. They were not invented for crypto. They were popularized for crypto, but they're not invented for crypto. And, you know, there's a lot of misunderstanding of them, mostly caused by groups that don't want to see perps exist, because perps solve a pretty significant problem, and I came from the world's largest commodity futures exchange. I love futures; they're incredibly efficient instruments. But the one problem they have is they're short or fixed duration instruments. If you want to hold the position for a long time, they just expire, and then you have to sell them and buy them back, and that's called the roll. And the roll is problematic for the long term holder for a lot of obvious reasons. You know, first and foremost, it costs money to buy and sell. Yep. Right? If you wanted to keep your car for 10 years, but every year you had to sell it and buy it back, that's not an efficient way to own a car for a long period of time. The second reason is the institutions know that you have to roll them. And when they know that you are forced to sell something and forced to buy something back, guess what they do? They step in front of both sides of that trade. So the roll is really, really good for exchanges, because it creates volume where, quite frankly, you shouldn't doesn't need to be. And it's really, really good for sophisticated market participants who can time those roles. So otherwise than that, perps are exactly the same. They cost about the same. In fact, over the longer periods of time, they're a lot more economically efficient than shorter dated futures. So crypto popularized them. We are offering them. We offer them for commodities. We offer them for pre-IPO equities. We'll also be offering post-IPO tokenized equities. And so the idea is that for every stage of the life cycle, you'll have the ability to get exposure if you want it. And that's really what we're solving for. If you think getting Knicks tickets are hard, try getting Series B Anthropic. You're not getting it. I don't care if you're worth $100 million, you're not getting it. That is a closely held group of individuals in every industry that get access to those. And by the way, to their credit, they're willing to take the risk of super early access, because for every Anthropic, right, there's 500 zeros. So if we can start to give people the optionality to get exposure to that entire value chain, then we can become the everything app. We can become a place people go to live their financial future.
Yeah, it's a good point, because when you think about the hurdles that it takes to get through some of this stuff, it's like, well, the bare minimum is you have to be an accredited investor or a qualified investor, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a tough hurdle for, I would say, the average retail trader you want to get exposed to some of these massive companies behind the scenes. And it's like, all right, well, that's the bare minimum. And then it's like you said, even if you are that, getting your hands on this stuff is still not easy. It might even be a harder stretch afterwards.
It's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
I mean, you made a great point. And so I think the more that we can open up access to these products,
I had a follow up on something you were talking about, John, actually, on just like the incumbents very clearly not wanting this technology with perps to go mainstream. I don't know if this was like a clickbait thing or if this was real, but I saw that the CME was suing the CFTC because the CFTC is letting perpetuals. Is that real? And like, I don't know if you guys are a party to that suit. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, I can't really talk about the suit because for obvious reasons, because we're offering those products. But the CME, it's public knowledge, the CME is suing the CFTC. That's an unusual situation.
I was like, is this real? This sounds too crazy to be real.
Anyway, I come from that world. I know a lot of those guys. I can't really talk about the case itself, but I'll just say this in general. I said this on CNBC this morning, actually. It isn't surprising to me that they would defend the moat. I get it. Mm-hmm. I understand, right? No different from money center banks being upset about stable coins, right? If I were getting free money from the government and then turning around and being allowed to charge 5% for people to borrow the money that I got for free, I would protect that business as well. Yeah. I would enjoy, right? If I was getting paid 5% from the government and I was turning around and giving 10 basis points to my checking account holders, that's a business I'd fight for as well. So none of this is particularly surprising to me. I think, over time, what's best for the American consumer tends to win, which is why I think you're seeing these rules coming out, whether it's SEC interpretive rules or CFTC no action letters or hopefully the Clarity Act and the Genius Act. It takes a while. It takes longer than people want. But eventually, we do live in a democracy, so we can vote in people who will do what's in our best interest. And that seems to be grindingly happening.
Yeah, on that same point about it grindingly happening, I see the odds of the Clarity Act passing in 2026 pretty much at a coin flip. I checked 2 days ago, it was 43%. Today, 49%. In March, it was 70%. And so I'm just curious, does Coinbase have a firm level view of where the Clarity Act stands, if it's going to happen this year? Does it matter for you guys? I've heard some folks come on the show and say, pass or no pass, we're still going to be building the business. It's still going to, not have a huge.
We want it to happen. Let's be clear. We want it to happen. I know Paul Gruel is our fantastic general counsel, and Farhad Shahzad is our fantastic head of policy. And, they're competent, confident. I just quote their public statements on Twitter. They think it's going to pass. And I'm confident as well. Right? People forget, like, Genius, up until the week before Genius passed, it was a coin flip as well. Like, there's no guarantees about this. So I believe in Paul and Farriar, and they've done a great job. And so I believe in what they're saying is right. They're much closer to the action than I am. But I will say this, Coinbase is no, I was asked this question as well, like, what's the big catalyst? So I think you have to stop looking for a big catalyst, quite frankly. So even if Clarity passes, I think to some degree, some of that's been priced in. So I don't think we're going to have this massive run up just because Clarity passes. But you have to be comfortable with the notion that of two things. One is Clarity passing is a fundamental building block of the longer term institutionalization of crypto and blockchain, so it can start to fix problems in U.S. capital markets and the economy, right? You just got to believe in that. And I know people want price to go up. I do too. But it's a very, very positive thing. If it doesn't, which I think it will, but if it doesn't, we still get to build. Stable coins have quadrupled since the passage of the Genius Act without the Clarity Act. And they will continue to grow because they're good tech. Payments are improving. We're seeing movement in the tokenization of equities that will happen with or without Clarity. All that will happen is some of this will happen offshore and U.S. citizens won't be able to benefit.
Which would not be the ideal scenario, I'll tell you that much.
No.
Back to the Genius Act being a 50-50 thing up until that week. That was the first time when the Genius Act got passed last year where I actually opened up C-SPAN and was like live streaming just the still shot of the Senate, everybody walking in, yay, nay. And I'm like there, like eating popcorn, just like, oh my gosh, is it going to pass? And I was so excited. My wife's like, what are you watching right now? I was like, it's the Genius Act, you know, like that Charlie Day, thing where you're like, you know, putting all the dots together for, it was exciting.
So I got to tell you a quick story about that. So last year, remember when everyone was talking about debanking?
Yeah, of course.
There was a Senate
and Trump
hearing.
Was talking about it too. He called out Brian Monahan from Bank of America.
Right. Mm-hmm. So there was a Senate hearing on debanking, and I'm on the board of directors of this entity called AIMA. It's the largest industry lobbying group for funds, and I was passionate about this. So I had AIMA do, or I helped AIMA do, really comprehensive survey work on its member base, which is thousands of people. And that survey was entered into evidence by one of the witnesses, a wonderful guy named Austin Campbell. So anyway, long story short, I got named, and he name dropped me. One of the senators who wasn't too fond of crypto made some comment like, is there any evidence of this? And he went, well, actually, John D'Agostino from AIMA and Coinbase. Yeah. And I'll tell you something, people watch C-SPAN. My phone blew up. It is people. It's like New York One, a local TV. It's like ASMR for people. They just watch C-SPAN all day.
I love it.
Yeah. It's funny, man. You just never know. You never know what you're going to get yourself into these days. But on a lighter note, you know, Coinbase also serves as really one of the primary custodians for a lot of these ETFs. We mentioned that earlier. But I was hoping you could expand upon it. Why is that, right? It's more than just saying, oh, there's a couple of Bitcoin spot ETFs now. Now there's a whole lot more than that. But Coinbase still serves as really the primary custodian when it comes to crypto ETFs. What does that mean for Coinbase and why is that?
Yeah, and I'm also curious about the business model there for you guys too.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I mean, look, I've been involved in many of these RFPs, one in particular, actually in Saudi Arabia. And, quite frankly, speaking to the folks who conducted the RFP, and I don't like talking bad about competitors, but there is an advantage to being public for as long as we have. It's just that simple. It's like I kind of liken it to the Kenyan marathoners, you know, training at ultra high altitude since they're children. Right. You compound that training, you compound that exposure, you compound that difficulty over time, and you just produce a more hardened athlete. And I think the way to think about Coinbase custody is it's a very, very hardened athlete. And that's a reason why we are, I think it's over 95%, and the only major ETFs that don't choose us have their own custody. Because I think when you put us up relative to that institutional requirement, there's really no competition. And there's some things that we can't do as fast as others and whatnot because we have to be highly locked up. but those institutions appreciate that conservative nature. So, and the business model, you know, is as you would imagine, there's a custodial fee based on base assets that kind of goes down as you step up the number of assets. We obviously also want to lend against those assets. We offer, for example, if you want to keep, there's different products. If you want to keep your assets in cold storage for security reasons, we can loan you effectively the asset to sell so it doesn't have to move into hot wallets. There's bridge financing. So there's a number of different ways that we can, that that business makes money for us and we can help clients. But they take a lot of comfort in the fact that we have the most secure custodial solution in the world.
Yeah, it seems to me, at least from an outsider's perspective looking in, that there's never been a serious breach of, you know, customer assets. And once that trust is that right?
No, there's never been never been a breach of customer assets at Coinbase.
Yeah, and once that trust is broken, it's just so hard to kind of regain it back. And so I think that's just one of the other stamp of approvals. And it's one of the, you know, the exchanges that we always sort of tell our folks who watch the show, just like, hey, this is, you know, state of the art in terms of where you're going to hold crypto, trade crypto. And it's just so cool to see, you know, beyond the security, how much you guys are innovating. I mean, you guys really are rolling out updates like you are a startup, but there's already, you know, what, 3,000 people that work there at Coinbase now. So it's really cool to see the balance there.
Yeah, 3,000 or so. Yeah, look, I mean, they set, you know, Brian sets very aggressive targets. we're told we're launching this thing on X date. And I mean, he did a podcast or he posted something the other day about, you know, the value of setting these close to impossible targets. Because it is extraordinary how much you can get done if the whole team knows you have no choice but to get it done. So we are very, very close to launching security tokenization, both hopefully in the US, but definitely ex-US shortly. We've got perps live. And one of our most popular products were commodities perps, so gold and crude oil, for obvious reasons, right? I mean, if you think about, you know, about a year or so ago, if we had a situation like we have in Iran and the U.S. launched a missile or the Iranians attacked a ship in the Strait of Hormuz on Friday at 6 p.m., you would have to wait until Monday morning at 9 a.m. for NYMEX to open. Now, obviously, you don't need to do that. And so once, to your point, once that horse is out of the barn, you know, I ask people, do you think we'll ever go back to watching movies when movie theaters tell us we can? Right, there's about the same level of likelihood of that as a trader waiting 36 to 48 hours to hedge their exposure. And so if you think about kind of where we're going with tokenized equities, right? So it's not that I think that every single night we'll have the same liquidity we have during the day for the S&P 500. But once you tokenize the entirety of the S&P 500, every single night something happens that affects a company, an industry, a sector. And so to have the optionality to go and get liquidity and hedge your exposure overnight. That's an extraordinary change.
Yeah, no, that's huge. You know, I think about like pretty much all of the market moving events I feel like happen after the market closes, whether it's earnings or people are doing mergers or reverse, you know, mergers, and you know, the FDA is coming out with announcements for different things. It's like none of that happens during market hours. I mean, even the president was waiting to declare war after the market closed. It seems like all the interesting things, and I even heard a great stat about like overnight drift. Basically, if you bought every S&P close and sold every open, you would outperform that actual returns of the S&P. So,
Bryce, that's a big unlock. Because the price doesn't actually stop. You just can't see it.
Right.
So I remember when we were at NYMEX, every time the price of crude oil, natural gas or something would spike, sometimes we get protesters outside. Like literal protesters saying, you know, shut down the exchange. And I remember one, this was during Occupy Wall Street. I walked around and I started talking to some of the people. And I was like, look, maybe you'll be successful. Maybe you'll close down the exchange. I don't know. But you understand that the only thing you'll be doing is hiding the truth from yourself. Mm-hmm. Because when the market opens tomorrow, or let's say you shut this whole thing down and never opens again, you're going to have horrific pricing because you'll be able to get robbed by everyone because there's no pricing benchmark.
Yeah.
So hiding, blaming the exchanges is I get it from a gut emotional perspective because it's the thing telling you how the price is going up and you feel bad about that. I get that. But all you're doing is denying yourself the information you need to make a decision.
Ignorance is bliss, as they say. But you don't want to be living in ignorance, I'll tell you that much. Now, look, I've got a little gear shift here for us. I feel like we, you know, have to talk about the volatility we've seen in the crypto markets as of really 2026. I think Bitcoin's down more than 30% year to date. Ethereum's down, call it 50% or something around there. But I have seen, again, been watching some of the CNBC episodes that you've been on, and you've been vocal that family offices, sovereign wealth funds are actually on the bid. They're buying during this drawdown. So I'm curious, during all of this extreme fear, a lot of this question about, you know, the Bitcoin bear market, now everybody's like, well, how long is this going to last? From your vantage point, what are you seeing?
Yeah. So
from the smart money,
I've been super lucky in my life. I've worked with some of the best investors, both literally some of the best investors. Yeah. I worked around them, with them, you know, John Arnold from Centaurus, Taka Sparagas from Alkion, just really extraordinary people. And the one thing I've learned is the short answer to your question of how long can it last? It can last twice as long as you think it can, in both directions, on the upside and downside. So what I see happening right now, and so the question that everybody has is, well, if they are buying, if the institutions are buying, why is the price falling? And again, I understand the nature of that question. That's a fair question, especially if you just don't have a lot of experience with markets. The reason is that while I would love it if institutions would ride in on their white horse and prop up the price of everything they like, that's not how they think. If anything, they trade on momentum. And so they're interested in getting the best price over time. So if they see weakness, they are not going to stop that weakness. They are going to, if anything, they might accelerate the weakness. They might go short for a while before they pick up their long. And this isn't like the conspiracy theory, market manipulation nonsense. This is not that. This is rational behavior. They're going to watch the market. They're going to participate on the long and the short side. They don't get emotional about an asset. They're not only long an asset. The institutions are not your friends necessarily during these periods. However, they dramatically accelerate price increases because they follow momentum. So they help you on the way up. So what I can tell you is they're closely examining this asset class. This asset class is behaving exactly as it has for 15 years. This is the sixth or seventh cycle where we've hit new higher bottoms, then they rally to higher tops. And so if you're an institution that's done the work, an asset behaving exactly how it's behaved in the past is not scary.
You know, on a similar note, is there a divergence between what's happening with retail and institutional players?
There's got to be.
certainly from a sentiment perspective, there's no question. I think sentiment's about as low as it's been on the retail side. And you know, I wouldn't say sentiment's high or low on the institutional side. They're just plodding through the math. So you know, they're acting like they're supposed to act as good fiduciaries. And again, I'm talking about not the ones that are conduits for retail, like the ETF providers. I'm talking about the asset owners and the funds.
And you have to think that they have a longer term, more patient vision of all of this, right? Whereas I would imagine retail is a little bit more short term focused, probably a little bit more emotional, probably a little bit less patient, maybe more easily influenced. Is that accurate?
I think for the asset owners, certainly they can have, you know, 10, 20, 50 year visions, right? If you're lucky, if you're a sovereign wealth fund, you're thinking in terms of decades. I think for the hedge funds, you know, they can be more patient than retail for sure, and they certainly don't get emotional. They'll double, triple, quadruple down, but they have to worry about quarterly reporting, and they have to worry about year end. So they're not, I wouldn't say the most patient of capital. But what they're going to do is size it correctly based on momentum. Whereas I think some people, especially when they use leverage, they get over their ski tips a bit on what, you know, it never feels too big a position when it's going up. Right, people don't think about that when it's going up. They only think about it when it's going down. Hedge funds, you know, professional investors tend to size it properly, you know, whether it's going up or going down.
Yeah, it's a fair point.
You know, one of the things that, you know, I've heard discussed and had my own thoughts about is one of the reasons for kind of an accelerated descent in crypto over the course of the past 9 months or so is because of the accelerated ascent of AI and of several of these other, you know, adjacent technologies to AI, like the data center build out and, you know, all of these hard assets, and everybody is talking about nuclear energy and robotics. And it feels like when we all started investing in crypto, you know, again, almost a decade ago, there wasn't that, it was, you know, 0% interest rates. There wasn't that much, you know, interesting technology that was really in the public equities market, I feel. Maybe that's just my memory. But now it's like, man, there are so many really other interesting areas to invest. Even in my own personal brokerage account, I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'm pretty loaded up on crypto. Maybe I'm going to try some robotics stuff. Maybe I'm going to deep dive on the AI semiconductor stuff. And that has been potentially, and again, I want to get your opinion on this, is that a liquidity suck or an attention suck or everything from crypto, which used to be where all of the tech visionaries were sort of pointing towards? And maybe that'll come back.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question. I mean, AI investment has been just astronomical. It's been unlike anything we've ever seen from a CapEx perspective to a liquidity perspective. So there's no question that that's playing a role. Prediction market interest is playing a role. You know, again, I think that's why Coinbase strategy is to be the everything app, right? So we have prediction markets, we have pre-IPO markets, we have tokenized securities markets for some of those names that you're talking about. I think like the internet itself, financial services will become to some degree about the attention economy. And we have to make ourselves the one-stop shop for all things in your financial health. So I agree. I think that all things mean revert. I don't mean to say I think there's going to be a massive correction in AI stocks anytime soon, but attention certainly mean reverts. So, you know, we just have to build when people are looking the other way. And we have to offer these products that get their attention onto our platform and then let them make the decision which of those products is right for them.
Yeah. No, I think, it's a great sort of synopsis of what I was trying to explain in my own feelings. And I think you kind of hit the hammer on the head. One of the other things that I want your thoughts on is, like, you know, crypto used to be, or Bitcoin particularly, you used to really be this digital gold thesis, right? When the government is overspending and irresponsible and misdirecting capital, you know, crypto and Bitcoin is this alternative asset that's really outside of the purview of government, and people could rush into crypto when, you know, they're having policy errors and all that kind of stuff. Do you feel like the digital gold thesis is still intact? Do you view it more as, like, you know, I've heard other people say, oh, crypto's down because the software stocks is down, right? Software stocks are down because AI now makes anybody with, you know, a brain and a $20 subscription currently the ability to create their own software. And so where do you kind of stand on the high level understanding of, like, where, or should I say, what is Bitcoin?
So I got to start with a quick little story. That's how I explain things.
I love stories.
So when I was at the NYMEX, you know, there was a lot of, back in the day, so commodity hedge funds were crypto funds before crypto funds, meaning they were the hot new darling on the street. They were making just outlandish, outsized returns. And we would talk to them. And the earlier ones, the first tranche of them, went around telling everyone, hey, look, the great thing about investing in commodities is it's zero to negatively correlated with equities and fixed income. And they all got wiped out and they all got sued. And then the next tranche of commodity funds came in, and I sat down with them and said, okay, just don't say that, because here's the big dirty secret. When people panic, all correlations go to one. That's just a reality. It's reality of us as a species. The 9 or 10 quant trading firms in Chicago that control 60% of all order flow in the world, those algorithms are written by the same 150 programmers. So we are a panicky species that when things go bad, we tend to all do the same thing. And so I think Bitcoin, I do believe in Bitcoin as the digital gold thesis. I think it's more powerful than digital gold because I think the new modern commodity is compute and power, and that's what Bitcoin creates a ledger for. That's what it stores, if you will. So I think it stands alongside gold in a complementary fashion, not in a competitive fashion. Gold has had problems over the year. Gold has not behaved the way you want it to behave at many, many points in time, the beginning of the great financial crisis, et cetera, et cetera. So the fact that Bitcoin is not behaving the way we want it to is not a function or a failure of Bitcoin. It is largely a function of failure of us as investors. We are not the most thoughtful investors. In short periods of time, over longer periods of time, that comes out. So I do think that it serves its purpose. It's you know, every 40 or 50 years, we as a society, we create a new store of value. And the notion that we haven't created a digital one up until now is kind of silly, given we've been as a world for the last 30 or some odd years. So I think Bitcoin is that store of value. I think it's reached that tipping point of critical mass where the cost to unwind it exceeds the cost to continue it. Mm-hmm. And so I see it continuing to function. Not everyone's going to want it in their portfolio, and that's okay. You're not dumb or Luddite if you don't want this particular asset or versus that. But it is now firmly established as an option with very, very unique characteristics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I get it. We want these things to behave the way we want them to. But that's not a function of the asset. That's a function of us as a market.
Yeah. Also on that point about the correlation stuff, sorry to interrupt, Brendan. One random thing is like I noticed like the 1 year sort of rolling correlation between Bitcoin and the S&P 500 is at like an all time low. And so we've got typically like a really highly correlated sort of view of, you know, if crypto goes up and stocks are going up, they're going to go up and down together. But that hasn't really been the case this year. So it kind of makes it maybe more attractive for an institution to look at it and say like, hey, like, you know, we're going to have stocks and we're actually going to get like a non-correlated asset in Bitcoin because it just hasn't had that tight of a correlation.
Brendan, yeah, you sorry want to interrupt, say
Brendan. Yeah, well, you know, mine was a little bit off that path, but I think it's a good point because people have been watching that, Bryce, right? I think people have been watching the movements of crypto here really over the last, you know, you could say the end of last year, but really this year, right? Because everything came down with a lot of the geopolitical news and all these other uncertainties that we've kind of seen thrown our way. But on the recovery, you've seen this extremely sharp recovery in tech. You obviously had metals melt up to the upside in that historic run. You saw tech kind of go on this massive recovery to new all-time highs. You know, right. Most equities kind of did that as well. You know, energy surged up to these record levels. And then you had crypto, which right now, you know, we're basically sitting at cycle lows here for the last year or two for a lot of these assets. And so I think people are looking at that, Bryce, and it's a good point. Yeah. And I think the idea of it being somewhat uncorrelated, people look at that and they go, oh, well, that's a bad thing. Everything else is doing good. And it's not, but you're right. I think it just helps people look at it in a different way. And it really is its own asset class. Now, I mean, you've looked at it evolve into a multi-trillion dollar asset class. And I think it is honestly best that it does behave in its own sort of way. But I want to...
Silver's down by 50%. Crude oil is
also down by...
the Iranians shot at a tanker less than 72 hours ago. And crude oil is still trading under 80.
Yeah.
Last time I checked. So... you know, look, you've got to be prepared. I'll quote Jeremy Grantham, ironically, given what he just did on CNBC. He had I've devoured his letters over the years. And he's got some great lines. And he says, you know, markets can be gloriously inefficient. And true. He says, and they can go against you until you lose your heart and your mind. And the trick is to be persistent and to survive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this was never going to be. I mean, I feel sympathy for folks who watched Bitcoin's early days and did some basic linear interpolation and said, oh, it's going to keep growing at 10,000% per year forever. You know, things can't grow that fast.
You're right.
They can't compound. They'll be larger than the global economy pretty soon. So it's not linear interpolative, it's a sine curve, but it's a sine curve that increases over time. We've got more adoption coming. What I tell people who say, what's the catalyst? My new thing is that I'm lucky enough to work at Coinbase, so I get to see what I call micro catalysts on almost a weekly basis. New clients, new sovereigns, new nation states, new products we're offering, the prime offering. We now have a so we never really had that in this industry. We now have a prime brokerage offering that is equivalent to the prime brokerage offering that exists for equities and credit. That allows for thousands and thousands of new institutional clients to engage with this asset class in the way that they know how.
It's a good point. And kind of realigning us with what institutions are thinking and what the institutional side is doing here, like how is the institutional allocation shifting just beyond Bitcoin and Ethereum? Because I think that's the popular thing. Everyone always brings it up. People probably see a million clips about it. But beyond the big two, beyond Bitcoin and Ethereum, you know, is there, and if so, how is that institutional allocation kind of shifting beyond?
So that's a great question, because it's the boring stuff that builds a great business, right? So we have over $1 billion out on the lending side. We're looking to grow that substantially. This is very, very high quality credit at great rates. So there's a massive institutional credit component that's growing very fast. As I mentioned, our perps market for commodities and pre-IPO equities is growing very, very fast. That's a very, very exciting place for funds to play, because if you're your job is to find alpha, and if you're limited, there's I forget how many stocks there are on the New York Stock Exchange. I think it's less than 3,000. If you open up a new array of potential liquid to semi-liquid security type instruments, you're creating new sources of alpha for these funds that have been starved for alpha for a very long time. The reality is 75% or more funds don't beat the S&P 500. That's down a lot from previous years. So we're offering these institutions through lending products, through alternative equity type exposure, alternative commodity type exposure. We're offering them new ways to gain alpha, and we're getting them to do it all or mostly on chain, and eventually all on chain, which just makes everyone's life a hell of a lot easier. So institutions, they're hungry for new types of exposure, and they really haven't gotten that over the last 20 years. So this is a learning curve for them, but this is what we're offering.
I love it. Look, John, I mean, we greatly appreciate the time that we've spent with you, and to kind of round out the discussion, I want to ask the question that's probably burning in all the listeners' hearts and wallets is, what's it going to take to kick this bear market in the groin and finally slap the bull on the butt and get it moving in the right direction? Is it going to be a slow sort of, we got to have a slow bottoming process? Is there something in the technicals that you guys are looking for? Again, your personal opinion. Is it that landmark regulation? Is it a big name starting to buy crypto? How do you kind of think about this?
Yeah, I'm sorry to be boring here, but again, I had the luxury of learning from some of the best in the world, and one of the best equity tech investors of all time. I already said his name. I'll say it again. He's very private. His first rule is that he runs a $40 billion tech fund with an outstanding track record. I worked for him for several years, and his first had three rules, and one of them was, don't try to market time. So the only thing that's going to get out of this bear market is time. And if you're committed, figure out what you're willing to allocate, slice it up and dollar cost average in, because you will be happier a year, 2 years, 5 years from now, as everyone has been when they've bought into high quality assets during bear market periods. Now, I want to give you a more honest answer. Even though, I was a little bit sanguine about it before, I do think clarity passing is important. I do think that I don't think people who have the interest and willingness to buy crypto now are waiting until post clarity to buy, but it does accelerate the onboarding of a lot of large institutions and increased capacity. So I think that clarity, again, maybe not immediately following clarity, but it does make the industry healthier over time. And then that's about it. I think you have to believe in the asset class. And you know, you can see from our reports and from what we put out, you know, we are very, very excited about the state of the industry. And you know, time, that's the only answer.
Awesome. Well, I'm not going to let you go. It's something you just said about clarity made me kind of spark my imagination there. Which is like kind of, again, this will be the last question. But the Clarity Act, like, why does a bank, or why do some of these large fiduciaries, you know, why are they waiting for the Clarity Act? Why do they need that designation of like, this is for sure a security, this is for sure a commodity? And once we have those, you know, regulators who were responsible to report to, then we could jump in. Why is that so necessary?
It's a great question. Look, we have to be honest with ourselves about our industry. Our industry is still small, mm-hmm. right? Crypto overall, crypto, just as an investable asset class. Blockchain's eating the world. There's no question. It's solving massive problems, integrated into ledgers all around. But crypto as an investable asset class is still small. It still represents 2.5 to 4% of global equities, real estate, fixed income. So if you're a massive organization, you get it philosophically. You've got younger employees chomping at the bit to invest in these assets. You've got some subsection of your customer base that's calling and saying, "Hey, we'd love for you to do it." But crypto has punched above its weight to some degree in a very real way. I mean, it's extreme. Given the size of the asset class overall, the fact that we have BlackRock and Fidelity and Schwab and all these folks in it is and the fact that Amazon is accepting crypto payments. This is an extraordinary testament to the value of technology. But these institutions have to make ROI positive decisions. So they're looking at the size of the asset relative to the rest of their business. And they're saying, okay, we get it philosophically. We like the young partner that is excited about it, and we're going to let him or her run with it. But to make that capital investment in a fiduciary way, especially for a public company, they have to be able to tick all the boxes off of the major things that could go wrong. One of the biggest things for these institutions is regulatory clarity. So it's a new asset class. They're looking for some type of guide to it. We've got some of that in Genius, which is why stablecoin usage has exploded. And you don't hear institutions arguing about whether or not they can get into stablecoins because they have Genius. So clarity provides that security net needed to justify the decision to invest in a small but growing industry. It's Love not it. Unreasonable. It really isn't.
Yeah. They're playing not to lose at the end of the day. And one of the ways that they could lose is by tripping afoul of securities law or something, I guess.
I get it. Again, I'm sympathetic. I'm not in that position, but I'm sympathetic to that position. So I think, you know, market structure, also, you know, the fact that we're considering passing market structure for this asset class is also testament to how important this asset class is. We don't pass market structure very often in this country. Generally, we pass it to fix a massive problem when there's been some massive financial crisis. And so the fact that we're looking to create proactive market infrastructure, regulatory infrastructure, for an asset class that, again, represents less than 5% of equities is extraordinary. And we should be proud of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. John D'Agostino, thank you so much for coming on, head of Coinbase's institutional strategy. Where could people follow along on your personal journey, as well as, of course, Coinbase's journey?
Well, we have our Coinbase Institutional at Coinbase Institutional on X. I'm at John J. D'Agostino. Very, very cool name I made up. And obviously the Coinbase tag on Twitter. We put out a lot of great stuff. We put out our research notes, I'm pretty reachable. So if any of viewers want to reach out to me, I'm pretty easy to find on LinkedIn or Twitter.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, and everybody who is watching or listening today. We really appreciate your support and your interest. Come back same time, same place next week. We'll have some more great guests for you. Thank you, John. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.